everyone. We hope you're staying positive and safe during these difficult times. This podcast is part of CIS Alumni's Community Service Initiative, with the aim to look into topics affecting our society and how we can learn more together and be inspired to make a bigger impact to our community. We are also currently running a CIS Alumni mask donating initiative, and we need your help. For more details, you can email alumni@cis.edu.hk or connect with us on Facebook. With over 70,000 confirmed cases and more than 2,000 deaths across the world, the spread of the COVID-19 novel coronavirus continues to cause anxiety all over the world. My name is Tiffany, class of 06, currently an ophthalmologist at Caritas Medical Center, and I'm here today with three of our most distinguished alumni members who are in the front lines fighting this battle. Alfred, class of 02, is an associate consultant at the intensive care unit at Queen Mary Hospital. Alfred, as an ICU doctor potentially taking care of the most serious COVID-19 cases, what are some of the challenges you face on a daily basis?
Thank you, Tiff, for the introduction. So I think the most challenging part of my job during the COVID-19 outbreak, maintaining a high quality of care, yet not putting myself and other staff members at risk of getting infected during the process. Patients who get admitted to ICU are generally very ill, and specifically to those who are infected with the coronavirus, these patients suffer from respiratory failure. As part of their supportive treatment, they may require oxygen to assist with their breathing. And if severe enough, these oxygen will be delivered at an extremely high flow rate, which can cause their oral secretions to aerosolize and infect healthcare workers. If they're struggling to breathe on their own, doctors will also need to intubate them and connect them to a mechanical ventilator. And the process of intubating an infected patient can be dangerous for us, as we need to get very close to the oral cavity, which contains a lot of their infected secretions. To protect ourselves, we put on N95s, goggles, face shields, gloves, and protective gowns whenever we are in contact with these patients. But these protective gear can be quite suffocating. The face shields can fog up very easily, can get lightheaded from wearing an N95 too long, and people start to panic when that happens. So for the past 2 months, we have been training and running drills with our nurses and doctors on how to efficiently perform our task in the full gear without compromising patient care. And this includes intubation and performing CPR. In general, we try to limit the number of staff being exposed. We've modified the sequence and methods of how certain procedures are being performed. We make sure everyone is briefed and knows their role before attending the patient. And most importantly, we make sure there's a plan B in case things don't go as expected. Fortunately, no one I've attended to so far is a confirmed case. But in the event that happens, I have a consensus with my wife that we will be staying apart until the situation improves.
So next question is for Oscar. In public hospitals, doctors are divided into dirty teams and clean teams. Dirty teams deal with suspected or confirmed coronavirus patients, and clean teams deal with all the other patients. So Oscar, as a cardiologist working at Rungji Hospital, can you tell us how people are selected into the dirty team, and what is it like to be working in one?
I think various hospitals and departments have different protocols in terms of selecting who's going to be going into dirty teams. But for example, in my hospital, all of the junior staff, essentially all staff who normally have to do ward rounds, all their names get put into a pot, and all our names are getting drawn into a list of order. And in my hospital currently, we currently have 3 members per team. Every 2 weeks, we have a rotation into the dirty team, and we'll be split doing morning, evening, and night shifts. And luckily for me at the moment, I've been rostered to do this dirty team at a very late stage. It's been estimated that I won't be in a dirty team until late May or early June. And I'm hopeful that by that time, then this epidemic may be over. I think a lot of the anxiety, especially from a frontline point of view, would be getting infected during our duty. Obviously, personal infection may not be a big problem, but the fear is that we could spread it to our friends and family. And it is true that a lot of our colleagues who've been into the dirty team and have worked these dirty shifts, they call, they've basically had to rent out hotel rooms and service apartment, or what they would call a washout period, for them to then have 14 days where they can then self-quarantine to make sure that they weren't infected before then they return to their home to make sure that the family is safe.
Okay, that must be really tough staying away from your family. Jen, as a pregnant ophthalmologist, what is it like being a pregnant doctor in this period of time? And do you think the hospital is giving you enough support?
Thanks, Tiff, for that question. Yeah, At the moment, I'm entering my third trimester of my pregnancy, and in my line of work as an ophthalmologist at Grantham Hospital, most of my patient contact is either through the outpatient clinics or through our day surgery department. And in terms of the impact that this coronavirus epidemic has had, it's had a definite impact on my work and also on my personal life. In terms of the impact on work, we've had a huge increase in a need for PPE or personal protective equipment, which has become severely limited. And we do need to wear them, especially for suspected cases. But even for supposed low-risk cases, we need to, during the course of our examination for these patients, we do need to get into quite close contact with them. So we will have our face masks, we will have our face shields or goggles, which unfortunately may not work very well with the examination. So I've had to go out and buy my own plastic glasses, which would help me shield my my eyes a little bit while I'm doing a slit lamp examination. We also have patients screened at the door of our clinic, in terms of checking their temperature and also for their travel and contact history. But unfortunately, we still have encountered patients who may conceal their travel history from us, and we only realize, say, that they've recently been into China once they're in our consultation room, which is a big source of stress, both for other patients who may have been sitting near these clients for some time, and also for the doctors and the nurses and other healthcare assistants. So there's a definite infection risk in terms of even during these supposed low-risk outpatient clinics. We've reduced our clinic cases as much as we can, which has had an impact on the type of non-emergency cases that we can see. And in terms of the impact on the personal life, of course, I've been very worried about the fetus as well as, the infection risk to my husband and my kids and the extended family. And of course, on top of that, the other social issues of social isolation and, the fact that my child has no school to attend, and we have to be very aware of hand hygiene and hygiene at home for both the kids and adults.
Thank you, Jen. Moving on to other issues that people are probably pretty concerned about, let's talk about protective gear. We talk about PPEs, N95s. Are all these things in a shortage right now? Are they as important as we think? Do we need to be going out to supermarkets and PPEs and N95s? Is it safe to go out without a mask? Can I still meet my friends for dinners and go gym?
Personally, I'm trying to balance vigilance with the mental health benefits from going out, socializing. So while I might try to avoid crowded areas like public transport or markets, I would still try and see friends and do outdoor activities just to keep active.
In terms of the Center for Health and Protection, advice is that you should wear masks when you go to crowded places or when you're in public transport. But I do think that N95s are generally not required if you're just going out on the street. I think a simple surgical mask do the job just fine.
Also, I find that N95 masks in general, like Tip said, are very suffocating. If I have to wear them at work, I wear them for a minimum period of time because I do get more short of breath the longer I wear them. Just as important, or possibly even more important than wearing masks, is hand hygiene and avoiding touching your face.
What the general public are not aware of is that when medical professionals wear N95s, they actually have to go through a fit test to ensure that there's a very good seal between the mask and the face to avoid any inhalation of the droplets. For the general public, I think a surgical mask would be sufficient.
I agree, Alfred. I think in a lot of cases, if you're not fit tested for an N95, potentially wearing an N95 could be even worse than a surgical mask if you don't know how to wear one properly.
So if we talk about protective gear and HA, it's on the news every single day, how many masks we have left, how many PPEs we have left. Is there actually a shortage, and how does it affect your daily work, and how are we dealing with this?
Yes, Tiff, it's actually true that there is a shortage in surgical masks, N95s, and PPEs. We have been rationing our use on these surgical masks. So for example, if I were to attend a patient, of course I'll be wearing a mask, but afterwards if I were going to a tea break or going to lunch, I would try to reuse that mask actually by putting it into a plastic bag, and such that after my lunch, then I would use the mask again. It's not advised, but that's the way that we're going about.
The situation in public hospitals are quite similar. Not particularly in my department, but in some other departments, they have been limiting surgical masks that each person can use each day, for example. I've heard some colleagues are only allowed to use 3 masks per day. So you use one in the morning, you kind of throw it away for lunch, and then you use a second one for lunch, for the afternoon, and then you sort of keep one to go home and to come back work with the next day. You know, surgical masks are certainly in high demand, and I would sort of urge everyone to sort of use it wisely and don't bulk buy or panic buy if you've got plenty at home already.
Yes, Oscar, there are some hospitals that actually have only been able to hand out 1 mask per doctor per day, and it would be really difficult to, you know, to make it last an entire shift. I mean, if you imagine sneezing into your mask, as I sometimes do, because they're all a bit fuzzy, then ideally you should be throwing that mask away and replacing it. What I mean when I sneeze into a mask, ideally that mask should be thrown away, because once a mask gets wet, then its filtering ability is severely decreased. And I do know that our ward managers have had to lock the masks away. They're being treated with the same level of security as our controlled drugs now, unfortunately. These are the strange times that we live in.
I think we've been mentioning a lot about frontline people who are in need of masks, but I just wanted to highlight here that a lot of healthcare workers are also in need of masks, and some of them are actually at higher risk of contacting the virus than I am. For example, healthcare workers who change bed sheets, who transport blood samples, respiratory samples. To be honest, they are in contact with the virus at a longer period than I am.
With so many asymptomatic cases and mild cases not seeking help or not making it to the hospital to get tested, wouldn't you say that this death toll is grossly overestimated?
Yes, Steph. I think there are some people who are saying there's an overestimation on the mortality rate, mainly due to 2 reasons. One is there are a lot of mild or asymptomatic cases, especially in Wuhan. And secondly, there are also a lot of people who are being turned away from hospital because the hospitals there don't have the capacity to take them anymore. So that's going to have a huge impact on the denominator of the number. So you have a lot of people who may be undiagnosed with the coronavirus, but then don't go on to die.
Yes, Oscar. But at the same time, I can also argue that there may be an underestimation of the mortality rate, because some people who might have passed away have simply not been diagnosed or who were not diagnosed in time to be counted as a death due to a coronavirus. So I think in the end, there's still a lot of unknowns with this virus, and only time will tell.
I agree.
So is there a cure for this? We hear the news talking about a lot about ribavirin, Caltrate. Can you talk a bit about those?
So in terms of treatment for coronavirus, I think we can split this into 2 parts. Number one is the general care and supportive care for our patients who has respiratory failure. And number 2 is the definitive care that we can actually give medications to these patients. So for example, in my line of work in intensive care, what I provide is a supportive treatment in terms of oxygen therapy or mechanical ventilation. In terms of the definitive treatment, there are a lot of clinical trials that are actually going on. And in my unit, for example, there are some studies that are using Caltrate, which is a HIV medication, and also ribavirin and also interferon. We don't know if they work yet on patients, and I think clinical trials are ongoing. Oscar, do you have more experience with the use of these medications? Because in my unit, I have not prescribed them yet.
Personally, as I'm not in the dirty team at the moment, I don't have personal experience, but I've had colleagues who've been using these medications to treat some of our patients at Rotunji Hospital. We've had 5 to 6 patients, confirmed cases in the past few weeks. And I think luckily, majority of them have got very mild symptoms. We've had a discharge patient last week, and you know, majority of patients, even though if they've got mild symptoms, they are being put on these medications that you've mentioned earlier.
There was a lot of side effects or long-term side effects from SARS patients using steroids. Are steroids being used now in public hospitals for coronavirus, or is that something we should be worrying about?
I think steroids are being used in selective cases. Who or when do we use the steroids and how much steroids is still an unknown factor. But there are definitely reports coming from all over the world with different expert opinions.
So right now, many people are afraid of going to the hospital. I know that A&E attendance has dropped significantly. As a member of the general public, if I have some sniffles, a sore throat, a low-grade fever, should I be going to a doctor, or what should I do if I think if I have the coronavirus?
Yes, we're really seeing a sharp drop in A&E attendances in my hospital. Normally, we'd be getting more than 300 A&E attendances each day. Now we're really only seeing around 100 or so. My general advice is really if you are in need of medical help, I would still seek attention as needed. The concern is that, you know, we're seeing patients who should have seen us 10 days ago now turning up 10 days later because they were in fear of attending the hospital. The problem with that is you miss the golden opportunity to have that disease diagnosed, whether it's coronavirus or not. And it's going to have a huge impact on our treatment plan for you as well.
And also with quarantine yourself to protecting your other family members and friends from catching the virus as well. So I think early diagnosis is very important.
And actually every A&E department in public hospitals have a designated area for patients with suspected influenza or respiratory symptoms anyway. Even before this epidemic started, there every flu season, there would be a designated area for suspected patients to wait away from other patients that do not have respiratory symptoms. So actually there is already some sort of separation when patients go to hospital. And we're lucky that actually our public health system so far has seemed to be able to cope with the number of cases in addition to the usual flu season as well. And so I agree with Oscar that patients shouldn't delay treatment for whatever medical conditions they may be suffering from.
I think if there's one thing that Hong Kong probably is better prepared than anywhere else in the world is that, you know, majority of us have been through SARS many years ago and have had the experience in dealing with this in terms of performing hand hygiene and social hygiene. And I think hospitals in general, in terms of infection control and having isolation rooms available, we are arguably, you know, better prepared than we were back in SARS. Obviously, in terms of personal protective equipment and staffing, that's another issue. But I think the general public in general are better informed and much more aware than when we were back in SARS.
I agree. And I think one thing that that struck me as being very different in terms of the experience of the coronavirus epidemic now compared to the SARS epidemic years ago is that social media has played a really huge part in how the public have reacted to the news about cases and whether or not there may or may not be a shortage of toilet rolls and masks and hand sanitizers. And unfortunately, this has caused a lot more worry and sometimes panic in the public. So, you know, as healthcare professionals, it's also our duty to try and communicate the risk of this coronavirus to the public without trying to sensationalize it all. And I hope that, you know, in some ways that this podcast would help as well.
One last question for you all. I know I shouldn't be lining up for toilet rolls, but what should I be doing to protect my family and kids?
Hand hygiene, definitely.
I think just prevent any unnecessary foreign travel, especially to the pandemic places like Wuhan, Hubei province, and mainland China in general, I think. And essentially avoiding close contact with anyone with fever or any respiratory symptoms.
Well, and if you don't have a mask, it's not the end of the world. Just avoid crowded places would, I think, be a good enough strategy to avoid getting infected or passing the infection to anyone else.
Make sure you maintain good environmental hygiene. Keep your doors open, keep your windows open, get some good ventilation in. Make sure you clean your home thoroughly, you know, at least once a week with 1 in 99 diluted household bleach. And make sure that for any other services, especially metallic services, you can disinfect it with 70% alcohol.
And also we should really pay attention to our mental health during this time, seeing as it's so easy to get very overly worried about this disease. Try and do some outdoor activities. Try and catch up with friends. Something to take your mind off all the troubles that have been going on.
Thank you, Jen, Oscar, and Alfred for your time today. And listeners, if you do want to help as well, CIS alumni are working on sourcing face masks that will be donated to local frontline doctors and NGOs. To learn more, or if you're able to help out in any way, please reach out to alumni@cis.edu.hk or connect with us on Facebook. This podcast is part of CIS Alumni's Community Service Initiative. Thank you for listening, and do reach out if you have any other ideas that enable us to connect, inspire, and serve.